This morning we hear the case of King versus Commonwealth. Is the appellant ready?
Yes.
Appley ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
We're ready when you are, so if you'll proceed, please. Ms. Wilson?
Yes,
And Ms. Wilson, do you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. The appellant chooses to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
3 minutes, yes, ma'am.
Thank you. May it please the Court. Appellant is asking the Court to affirm this panel's decision and reverse the trial court's failure to properly instruct the jury on the issue of accident. The issue of accident is both vital to the appellant's defense and sufficiently supported by the evidence at trial. Although the Commonwealth's theory in this case was that the shooting was malicious.
Counsel, could the jury have accepted, assuming the instruction had been given, could the jury have found that it was accidental as to the shooting, but nonetheless convicted of assault and battery?
No, Your Honor. It's not the defendant's theory that the appellant could have been convicted of anything if the shooting was, in fact, accidental. Because unlike the case in Waters, where there was an act actually being committed, assault being committed to the injured party, in this case, there was nothing intentional directed at the injured party.
Ms. Wilson, can I ask you, you brought up Waters. Waters has actually two holdings in it. One, that the accident instruction was adequately covered in other instructions, and the other was that it was an improper statement of law under the facts of that case. For setting aside that second issue and focusing on the first, it seems to me that Waters is very close to the case we have here. And if Waters is controlling, at least at first blush, it seems like you have some problems with your argument. On the other hand, at first blush, it appears to me that Martin, the Supreme Court case, is inconsistent with that first holding in Waters, because Martin seems to say that the instruction must be given regardless of the other instructions in a homicide case. You don't argue Martin as being controlling. You don't argue that Martin is inconsistent with Waters. And I'm curious why.
Your Honor, it's been the appellant's position all along that the correct statement of the law is that this court's sole responsibility is to see that the law has been stated and that the instructions cover all issues.
But is Waters inconsistent with Martin? Was Waters wrongly decided?
To the degree that, and Your Honor is correct in pointing out that there are two parts to the Waters decision, to the degree that Waters seems to suggest that in every case, if the instructions are fairly covered by the other instructions, then no other instructions are required. It's inconsistent with all the other precedential cases in the state of Virginia. In the Commonwealth, the Supreme Court, as well as this court, has long held that as long as the issue is adequately raised, that the proponent of the instruction is entitled to a legally correct instruction of the law covering all issues that are fairly raised by the evidence. In this case, Judge Kasabian found that the issue had been adequately raised. And I think Your Honor's question goes to the failure of Judge Kasabian's decision. When he reached his decision, and if you carefully read the transcript on that issue, he goes through Waters and he says, setting aside the distinction in Waters, the court clearly states in Waters that if the other instructions
the issue I have that I'd like some help on, and I'll ask this of the Attorney General at the appropriate time, the panel was bound by Waters, but we're not. And the question I have is whether Waters is inconsistent, was wrongly decided in light of Martin, and if so, should we overrule Waters?
I'd like to get your
thoughts on that.
And this is where the distinction comes in that Judge Kasabian failed to recognize that Your Honor so astutely recognizes. The court in Waters reached a decision based on two parts. First, it was looking at the early part of the instruction, the same instruction that was given in this case, but for the malicious wounding aspect. And it said, as the Commonwealth acknowledges, Waters' proposed jury instruction an accidental killing would have correctly informed the jury that it was the Commonwealth's burden to prove that the killing was not accident. And it goes on to look at essentially the first few sentences of the instruction that deal with the burden being on the Commonwealth. Then Waters goes on then to look at the last part of the instruction dealing with if after considering all the evidence you have reasonable doubt whether the killing was accidental or intentional, then you should find the defendant not guilty. This was exactly the jury's question in the King case. The jury wanted to know if it's an accident, is it an intentional act? They didn't have instruction on that.
If we assume that the jury understood the instructions and followed them, though, didn't they necessarily, as a matter of language and logic, have to reject accident, given the instructions regarding with the intent to kill or permanently maim, and regarding malice, which was then defined as an intentional act? So if the jury followed the instructions and if the jury understood the instructions, necessarily they had to reject your theory of accident.
That would be correct, Your Honor, if we presumed that all of the members of the jury have the knowledge that all of us as members of the state bar have, which is that we understand that an accident is not an intentional act. I don't believe that in this case, if the jury came back with that question, that it was clear to them.
Well, in this case, wasn't it instruction number 6 that said that malice can be presumed by virtue of the fact that a firearm was used?
It can be presumed as far as the intent of the injury, not the intent of the original act. It doesn't go to whether or not she intended to do anything directed toward this victim. And that's the problem with the case.
So is your argument essentially because they ask a question that in this situation, unlike in Waters, that the question required a clarifying instruction?
No, Your Honor, not at all. Because, in fact, it only highlighted the need that was presented through the evidence to begin with.
But if that's the case, and the instructions on malice, which required that it be intentional, the definition of malice shows it's anything but an accident, why wouldn't that be enough, whether there's a question, an additional question or not? Why wasn't the trial judge correct in just saying, I instructed you adequately before, you need to look at the plain language of those instructions?
I think that the panel's decision, the language used in the panel's decision is quite helpful. First, it states that view is too simplistic to think that if they're adequately covered, the other instructions are sufficient. It also talks about the fact that it's only giving the Commonwealth theory, the negative inference, rather than the defense's theory that, in fact, it was an accident and, therefore, it was not something she could be found guilty of any crime for under the facts of this case. And I think that it's also important to note that we're only asking that, as the panel held, under the unique facts of this case, that an accident instruction should be required.
What makes this case unique?
It's unique, Your
Honor. We're dealing with broad principles of law.
I agree, Your Honor, but I do believe that each case, whether or not the trial judge is required to give an instruction that adequately states the principle of law, has to be weighed. The evidence has to be weighed by the trial court judge to figure out whether or not it's appropriate in each given set of circumstances. And what Judge Kasabian failed to do in looking at the Waters test, even if it is an appropriate test, is that he didn't look at the second part of the Waters decision that specifically found that where he could have been found guilty, in this case King could have been, where he could have been found guilty of a lesser offense, that is, by committing an intentional act, he was guilty of, at the very least, involuntary manslaughter for committing the assault, Judge Kasabian just set that aside. And if the court erred in anything, the court failed to recognize that if the instruction properly stated the law, that it should have been given. And that's what the Waters decision said. Because it didn't properly state the law, that's why it shouldn't have been given. There's a distinction that's huge in this case that didn't exist.
Waters, though, involved a homicide, and the jury was instructed on involuntary manslaughter, which can be an accidental killing in the commission of a misdemeanor. Is there any offense involved in this case that the jury was instructed on that would support an accidental shooting conviction?
No, Your Honor. No. There is no offense that the jury was instructed on that would have supported the maximum shooting instruction. That would have not supported it. The instruction as drafted stating to the jury that if you find that it was an accidental act and not an intentional act...
Let me follow up on that, counsel, because it seems to me your own evidence was that there was a struggle over the gun. Now, that's not fleshed out in any detail, but it occurs to me that the jury could have been confused given that the instruction on assault and battery, that's why I asked my earlier question, if there was a struggle, you could certainly have an offensive touching or an assault in the course of the struggle that has nothing to do with a specific intent to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill. And that's, I think, is sort of the following up on Judge Petty's question. It seems a little confusing to me, or at least could have been confusing to the jury, if they believed your evidence, assuming that to be the case. I question whether they could not still have found a conviction for assault or battery, or certainly, or perhaps at least a battery, for example, under those facts. Could you respond to that?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that the best answer comes from Judge Kasabian himself, when he specifically made the finding that the issue was sufficiently raised. No, there was no dispute in the trial or in argument or in the post-trial motions about whether or not it was sufficiently raised. In fact, Judge Kasabian said it was sufficiently raised. There was no distinction made with respect to whether there could have been a lesser included offense or anything else. It was, if it was an accident, Judge Kasabian agreed. It was an accurate statement of the law. He said another judge could have given it and very well may have given it. But he believed, he's standing by his decision, because Waters said in its decision that the court does not err in refusing a proper jury instruction if the principles of law addressed in that instruction are adequately presented in the other instruction, which the panel found was too simplistic a view because it doesn't reach the issue of whether or not the defense proffered instruction, which also properly stated the law, should have been given when all the other instructions only created a negative inference. It never put forth the defendant's theory, the defendant's sole theory that was based on not only her testimony, but on the evidence from the medical record that it was an accidental shooting, the evidence from her son that she was depressed, and the DNA evidence that showed somebody else actually touched the gun. There was no dispute that there was other evidence of accident sufficiently raised that would have given rise to it. We believe in this case, Your Honors, that if the court reviews all of the evidence, there's no doubt that it was the trial court's responsibility to provide a correct instruction that accurately stated the law and was sufficiently raised in the evidence. We ask that this court reverse the trial court's decision and affirm the panel's decision that the instruction should have been provided. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Stallman?
Good morning. Can I please record? First of all, I am not arguing that the issues raised by the appellant at trial should not have been addressed in jury instructions. My argument is that those issues were adequately presented to the jury.
Well, Mr. Do you agree then that accident was the theory of defense and that it was supported by more than a scintilla of evidence?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Mr. Stallman, could you explain to me why Martin doesn't control this case? I just am having a real hard time with this.
Excuse me, just 1 minute. So there we go. Give your time on the clock. Thank you.
Your Honor, there's a body of law that seems to be somewhat at conflict in this issue. First of all, while Martin does seem to say that this is an instruction that should be given, there's also other cases that say the defense has no right to duplicative instructions.
Martin addresses this specific instruction. Martin was a homicide case. We have to assume that the jury was instructed on malice and premeditation, the same concepts here. And it just, I mean, we may have went off the tracks with...
I think we can assume that was done, but we don't know. I mean,
Mr. Stallard?
Yes, sir.
The instructions from Martin on second degree says the court instructs the jury that murder in the second degree is the unlawful killing of a human being with malice. And so it was almost 40 years ago, but Mr. Cassidy, your office made the exact same argument you're making here, and the Supreme Court rejected it. What do we do with that?
Well, I think since Martin was decided in 77, there's been other cases the Supreme Court have decided involving duplicative instructions and so forth. And I think the issue that's common to every jury instruction case is if the issues raised are adequately presented in other instructions, you're not, the defense is not entitled to multiple instructions.
Well, let me follow up on that, Ms. Fowler, because it seems to me if we take your argument to its logical extent, unless you're dealing with an affirmative defense, no defendant would ever be entitled to a specific instruction as to their defense if as long as the jury is instructed properly on the elements of the various offenses that the individual is charged with.
Well, I think that one of the purposes of the instructions, obviously, is to inform the jury what the state of the law is. The other issue regarding jury instructions is to allow the defendant or defense counsel and the prosecutor to argue their theory of the case to the jury. These instructions permitted defense counsel to make those arguments by saying the Commonwealth has the burden to prove this is an intentional act. The Commonwealth has to prove malice, either deliberate use of a firearm or an intentional doing of a wrongful act. And they can stand up before the jury and say they didn't prove that. This was an accident. Here's why they didn't prove it. That's one of the things the jury instructions permit defense counsel to do. Because they were permitted to make those instructions, make those arguments based on the instructions that were given.
Do you agree that Martin is directly on point?
Mostly on point. The difference is, and this is the thing that's not directly being addressed, is this is a homicide instruction applied in a malicious wounding contact, which does have some difficulties in application, first of all. Namely, the second part of the holding in Waters doesn't really fit in a malicious wounding contact. And I agree that it's not a neat fit, but I think there is some parallels there. So while it may be under Martin, if it is a homicide, it may be necessary. It's not so clear that in a malicious wounding issue, it is as relevant or as necessary as the Supreme Court said in Martin in a homicide context.
Mr. Stollard, are those the two distinctions you would draw, that since Martin there have been cases, although Martin has not been overruled, that the Supreme Court has suggested a different path? And the homicide distinction, do you have any other distinction?
I would also point out that Waters itself was appealed to the Supreme Court, and they refused it.
But that's not, refusal of writ has no precedential effect.
It's there for the fact that if it happened, the court can do whatever inference it wants to from that. I'm not arguing it's necessarily dispositive, but the Supreme Court had an opportunity, and they declined.
You're taking the position that, I guess your basic initial premise is that these instructions are duplicative, and while there's certainly some overlap, it seems to me if you have a specific defense such as accident, as a general proposition, you should be entitled to have correct instructions of law that relate specifically to what effect a belief that an accident occurred has on how to apply the law to the case. So, you know, you suggest that inferentially, by simply instructing on the elements, you get to the same place. But why wouldn't it ease any concerns for the jury, assuming a correct instruction of the law, to simply instruct them straight out that if you believe that this was an accident, that negates certain elements of the offense and go from there?
Well, Your Honor, again, I'm not saying the instruction could not have been given. I'm just saying in this case, the fact that it was not given was not error. Would it have been clearer for the court to give it? Maybe it would have been, maybe it wouldn't have been.
Well, this case is kind of unique, and while I agree with your general assertion that we don't look necessarily to questions to the jury to try to discern what they're thinking back in the jury room, this case is a little unique because the jury appeared to have some trouble with the concept of accident vis-a-vis intentional act.
Well, I mean, the questions the jury gave, again, ultimately don't matter for legal review, but as the court's pointed out, for whatever inference you want to draw from that, I would suggest, first of all, that first question, I don't think a judge could have answered that question any differently than this judge did, without invading the jury's province of doing any kind of fact-finding or trying to interpret what the
could have granted an instruction on accident.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Could have granted an instruction on accident.
I mean, even that instruction would not have answered the question asked by the jury. I mean, basically the jury is saying, was this an accident or not? That's what the jury's there to determine.
But if the purpose of avoiding duplicative instructions is to avoid confusion, jury confusion, don't we have exactly the converse here where we know for a fact the jury was confused? They were so confused they came out and asked a question about accident.
Well, I think if that's true, you can also look at the fact that they ultimately convicted of malicious wounding, therefore they necessarily found it was an intentional act, either to deliver.
But that's exactly what Martin addressed, because it said that although the jury rejected the theory of accidental killing by finding the defendant guilty of murder, That may be because the finding may have resulted from the mistaken belief that the burden was upon the defendant. So Martin actually answered that question.
Well, the problem is it's difficult to see from the instructions that were given how there could be a mistake as to who had the burden. The jury was instructed, the Commonwealth has the burden to prove each element beyond a reasonable doubt. And those elements include proving the intent that the defendant had was the intent to maim, disfigure, able, or kill. And if
that
they
seems to be a more general instruction on burden. And in Martin, the court says, it's a very brief per curiam opinion, as you know, but it says, in none of the instructions granted by the trial court, this is in Martin, they're similar to here. However, was the jury told that the burden was upon the Commonwealth to prove the killing was not accidental? I'll leave out the rest of the sentence. And then it says, although the jury may have rejected the theory of accidental killing by finding the defendant guilty of murder, because the finding may have resulted from the mistaken belief that the burden was upon the defendant to prove the killing was accidental, the error was prejudicial. What do we do with that language?
I would just have to go back to the fact that the jury, in this case, was instructed on all the issues that were fairly raised by the evidence. And if the jury believed this was an accident, if they followed the instructions as they're presumed to do, they could not have come back with a finding of guilt.
Maybe we need to leave this to be decided by another panel of jurors sitting in these same seats at a later time.
That may well come to pass one way or another, but I think the issue in this case, the trial court got it right. The instructions that were presented to the jury covered the issues that were raised, and the jury had the opportunity. These are not, I mean, the facts of this case may be somewhat unusual. The ultimate issues here are not unusual. It's a claim of a shooting, a defensive accident. Accident is not a term of art. I think accident is common knowledge. Everybody, I think, has a general non-legal view of what an accident is. And to say this was an accident versus they were acting with the intent to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill, that is not something that instruction, pardon me.
Counsel, while you're getting your water, I guess our problem is we've got two cases. We've got Martin and we've got Waters that are pretty on target. One saying one thing, the other saying another. Martin trumping Waters because it's a higher court. And while many of us may agree with you that there's a lot of case law out there that states in very general terms or in specific terms relating to different sets of facts that if the jury is properly instructed, they're, you know, the defendant is not entitled to just their own instruction. But how do we reconcile and get around the fact that Martin is the closest, Martin and Waters are the closest factually, and Martin seems to simply say that the defendant is entitled to the accident instruction on accident. It doesn't have to be the defendant's own instruction, but the jury should be instructed on accident.
Again, Your Honor, the clearest distinction, I think, is the fact that was a homicide and all of these Waters with a homicide. The case before you today is not...
But how is that? How does that make a substantive difference in the analysis?
To the extent that the instruction came from a homicide case, I think in the 30s or 40s when this thing first raised it, and it's in the homicide part of the jury instruction book. It's not an instruction generally given in malicious woundings. I'm not aware of it being given in any malicious wounding cases up to this case. There's no case law saying it has to be given in a malicious wounding case. This is the first time this court's had an opportunity to decide that, whether it does apply in other contexts beyond homicide cases. And again, I think...
Well, why wouldn't it?
Yes.
I mean, what possible rationale could there be to make that distinction?
Well, I mean, it was meant to be a general thing in all specific conduct, such as malicious wounding and unlawful wounding.
Well, what instruction in a homicide case, let me rephrase it, what instruction in a malicious wounding case would adequately apprise the jury of the burden of proof that wouldn't exist in a homicide case? Why is there a distinction?
I can't say that there's...
I mean, the jury in a homicide case is instructed on malice. They're instructed on willful, deliberate, premeditated, assuming it's a first degree. Here, the jury is instructed on that same concept of malice. The instruction's the same. And they're told that the defendant has to have an intent to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill. So I don't see any distinction between homicide and malicious wounding in terms of the concepts embodied in the other instructions.
And I don't disagree with your analysis, Your Honor. I mean, I know generally some cases are considered, like capital cases obviously get certain instructions because they are capital. It's just the nature of the offense that they are entitled to certain things. And it may well be that the Supreme Court has not had the issue directly before it decided whether or not malicious wounding is enough identical to homicide to warrant the same instructions. That's something that, up until now at least, is somewhat up in the air, although I freely admit I could be wrong in this issue. But I do think that what is settled law is that you don't get duplicative instructions, and the instructions that were given in this case, again, reiterating myself, that cover the issue, and again, the jury cannot have convicted had they honestly believed this was
except in Martin.
Well, again, the distinctions I've attempted to draw between this case and Martin, notwithstanding, yes, Your Honor.
But leaving it to the jury to draw a negative inference from the Commonwealth's instruction meant that there was no finding instruction for the defense on this theory of the case.
Well, the jury was told the Commonwealth has the burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was acting with the intent to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill. If they were not acting with that intent, if the Commonwealth failed to meet their burden, then they must acquit. That's not different than if this was an accident, you must acquit. I mean, that's kind of what's left, given the facts of this case.
Let me ask you this question. The U.S. Supreme Court has said its per curiam decisions have less precedential weight. Are you aware at the state level of any similar pronouncements? I'm not, but...
I'm not either, Your Honor, but I like that.
Can you elaborate a little further on your argument that because under the evidence in the light most favorable to appellant, that in the struggle or in the what was going on here, she was either attempting or getting ready to attempt suicide, or she was recklessly handling the firearm? How does that... Elaborate a bit more on how that affects this instruction issue.
Your Honor, that was the second argument. The fact that I believe her own evidence indicates she was engaged in unlawful conduct, either attempted suicide, attempted discharge of a firearm in a public building.
She was not charged with any of those offenses, though, was she?
She was not, but as a matter of law, under the homicide version, which is Waters talks about, if you have an accidental killing while committing an unlawful act, you're not entitled to an acquittal.
But Waters is a homicide, and Waters... The jury was instructed on involuntary manslaughter, which is an unintentional killing. What offense was the jury instructed on here that would have allowed it to convict if the wounding were unintentional?
I mean, I'm going to answer your question, Your Honor. I apologize. Just say this is one of the problems applying homicide instruction to malicious wounding. There is no identical layup to involuntary manslaughter in a non-lethal situation. It may be an unlawful wounding. It might be illegal. It's unclear from the law exactly which one of those you may be guilty of if you commit a
malicious unlawful assault and battery all require an intentional act.
Right. It's again, which is the problem. I think with applying this.
Well, the only observation to make on this is that second holding or second reaching in Waters is totally inapplicable to this situation, and we have to focus on the first reasoning about the otherwise properly instructed.
Well, it does seem to me, though, that if someone is, and I see I'm out of time, may I finish my answer? Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
I have one. Go ahead.
That if you're engaged in unlawful conduct, and even if you don't intend to wound somebody, but a wounding occurs while you're committing an unlawful act, it just seems reasonable that you should not be entitled to an outright acquittal. It seems like you have committed some offense, whether it's a simple assault, a simple battery, but something. It seems like just because someone didn't die that you get an outright acquittal. That does not seem to be an accurate summation of what the law should be.
My quick question is simply, would you agree that if the jury had believed that this was in fact an accident, there was no offense they were instructed on that they could have convicted of?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Stahl. Ms. Wilson, your remaining time.
Cheaper time is wrong. She's about 242 is what I wrote down, 242.
Do we need to overturn Waters to affirm the trial court here? I mean, to reverse the trial court here?
Under the unique facts of this case, I believe that there's a distinction in Waters that allows this court to affirm the panel's decision without having to overturn Waters.
Well, the panel's decision couldn't overturn Waters, so the panel analysis would be the answer that you'd want to provide, that the panel analysis got you to the point where you wanted to get to without necessarily overruling Waters.
Yes, Your Honor.
But the panel didn't even mention Waters. I don't think the Commonwealth brought Waters up at the panel, so where does that leave us?
Well, Waters was raised in the original briefing, and it was the case that the Commonwealth argued during the argument over Instruction L, the proposed jury instruction on accident.
At trial. But not before the panel.
And that was the instruction that was the case that the reason that Waters should be looked at and talked about in a written decision is the same reason every day all the citizens in the Commonwealth need Your Honors to make a decision that says this doesn't occur. Waters doesn't occur like this.
I don't think you've answered Judge Petty's question. How would you have us distinguish Waters? Let's put it that way.
I'd like it in an accident case. I'd like this court to say that when there's an accident and it is sufficiently raised and it applies to the facts of the case and accurately states the law, the instruction should be given. Just as all
that seems to be totally inconsistent with Waters. So it's that doesn't distinguish it. That basically suggests to me it should be at least partially overruled.
Your Honor, I don't disagree, but in my reading of Waters, I think that, whenever a court reaches a decision that's based on two principles, I don't know that the court would have reached the decision that it made, and it's speculation, if it weren't for the fact that the trial court judge already found that it just didn't fit the facts of the case. We'll never know with speculation. But in this case, it does fit the facts of the case. And to hold this broad principle that the court does not err in refusing a proffered instruction if the principles of law are adequately addressed in others, to every case without looking at the fact that it doesn't adequately address the defendant's theory on accident, it simply, as Stephen pointed out, it subjects any defendant in any different court, depending on what the judge wants to do. I like instructions that include accident. I don't think they're necessary. All the citizens of the Commonwealth are entitled to the same defense and to the same instructions being given to a jury that will assist in their defense. The broad principle stated in Supreme Court precedent that says if it's adequately raised and it accurately states the law, then it should be given. Judge Kasabian asked when the jury question came back, what would be the harm in giving an instruction to the jury? What would be the harm? This woman is sitting in jail for 8 years. That's the harm. And none of us, I still don't know whether or not the jury reached its decision based on a mistake or an accurate understanding of what the law of intentionality was.
You're at the end of your time, but if you could just wrap it for us, please.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much for well-done arguments on both sides. The court has the case submitted, and the court stands adjourned.
All right.